Lord is our Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa.
So, what would you like to hear? Did you find anything you want to go over again from the last 2 days? Or any questions? Or answers? Comments? And guess what? Complaints? Because I wanted to take a big jump otherwise. So I just wonder if you had anything you wanted to... Did you want to read the Four Gateways again together? Is that a good idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
You got your copy, Don?
Sure.
Okay. The Dagaba or Stupa represents manifest transcendence. The awakened body, voice, and mind of the teacher, and the eternal path that has been made clear through his kindness. By walking this path in response to hearing his teaching, we are led into union with him. The symbolism of this structure was described by the Buddha Shakyamuni as showing both the descent of the greatest ways of liberation and the joyful ascent to fulfillment. This double flow is imminently present everywhere. The key to unlocking this mystery is the power of awareness. When our lives are not seen as a precious opportunity, we wander blindly, driven by hunger for satisfaction. This is often referred to as caught in becoming. The only way to escape from this powerless state is to recognize the four gates that mark entrance to the transcendence. We cannot identify these gates until our own experience leads us to realize three truths. These three are as follows. Desire for what is not present is futile. Desire to be separate from what is present increases suffering. And desire to hold on to the present pleasure creates fear. Once this is understood, the feeling of being driven by hope and despair lessens, and renunciation dawns. With this new seeing comes an aspiration to know for oneself whether there is a more fulfilling way to live our lives. This aspiration turns the mind toward the four gates. Yearning for something more satisfying than material pleasure lessens our unthinking response to the crying of the four demons who ride on our shoulders from the time we are born. These demons represent one, avarice and grasping for positions and possessions in the hope of maintaining safety, the demon of hunger. Two, clinging to the known because of hating to be disturbed, dislike of change, the demon of sleep. Three, hunger for approval and adoration to ward off fear of rejection, the demon of sex. Four, obsession with control by wanting to know everything so we can escape the overwhelming fear of meaninglessness, the demon of breath. As long as we experience these insatiable demons as threatening to our happiness, we are caught. When we learn to meet them, they become the four other gateways, transformed into the attributes of prosperity, peace, seduction, and power. When we reach this point, rather than responding to the demon of hunger by grasping for positions and possessions, we are able to transform it into the power of prosperity, by becoming aware of all that is presently supporting and nourishing us in this life. In this way, feelings of pride and avarice open into awareness of beauty and the joy of kindness. When we are caught in anger and irritation, It is because the demon of sleep feeds our wish to drift in habituation without being disturbed by change. Using the power of peace, we are able to let the waves of hatred diminish by remembering the truth of impermanence. This lessens our tendency to cling to the known, allowing the mind to open to calm acceptance of things as they are, transforming the desire for sleep into the power of peacefulness. Thus, feelings of hatred are transformed into awareness of spaciousness and compassion. Addiction to bliss, which is symbolized as a demon of sex, causes us to pursue pleasure regardless of how inappropriate that pursuit may become. When that passion no longer triggers us to become oblivious of others, it becomes the beauty of seduction, turning our longing toward a greater goal and inspiring others to also seek true bliss rather than temporary pleasure. Thus, the passion for union with the all-too-fleeting temporal joy is transformed from self-indulgence to the sweetness of sympathetic joy. Fear of obscurity and grasping for dominance and control are the characteristics of the demon of breath. By knowing the art of true power, we can transform the jealousy that arises when this demon has gained ascendancy, thereby turning the mind to dwell in the calm, still point at the center of the whirlpool of unending activity. This stillness, which is always present within the waves and ripples of interbeing, is never caught by grasping for a fixed identity. In this way, jealousy is transformed into equanimity. The work of transforming these demons into the four powers is how one enters and walks through the first level of the path to liberation from suffering. At the second level, these four trainings manifest again, but now they appear as the four guardian yakshas, or wrathful protectors. When one has learned how to pass these four, access to the third level of realization is granted. The first of these yakshas lives at the base of a great mountain, which is constantly washed by the waves of a vast ocean. This being is furiously trying to prevent the base from being eroded by the waves. The second yaksha is turning a rosary, infinitely repeating his chant until the string breaks. The third yaksha is drunk on his partial achievement of realization, and so he has become distracted from complete understanding because he is very involved in less appropriate activities. In fourth place is a dancing yaksha. Indeed, he is hogging the stage. He offers his dance to entertain the transcendent because he understands that there is no such thing as amusement, but he has not yet let go of activity. One who succeeds in passing these guardians then enters the third level. At this stage, the four activities of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy and equanimity become universal in their scope. This marks the profound beginning of the Eightfold Path. As one traverses this path, it is understood that samsara is not separate from nirvana, symbolized by the rising energy of the spire reaching transcendent consciousness. Then the fourth stage, the descent from the crystal to the base, recognizing that neither is nirvana separate from samsara, immediately follows. The most secret harvest is thus completed. The body is rainbow energy. The mind is dharmakaya. The four gates are the four limitless elements arising in space. The four levels are the four seasons, the stages of coming into being and passing away that is time. Here is the holy point where time and space unite. Sarvamangalamo, blessings abound. questions, answers, comments, or complaints now? There's a lot packed into that three pages, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially saying that really the root of the of hunger, sleep, sex, and breath is self-grasping. Mm. When you're always looking for the next thing, there's an I who is insatiable. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
When you're always like wanting the next thing, there's an I who wants. There's an I who's insatiable. When you don't want to be disturbed, there's an I who doesn't want to be disturbed. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
When you are trying to just get your own pleasure and you just fuck everybody else, there's an I who wants to just get their own pleasure. Isn't there? And when you're always trying to stay on top of the moment and check and see where everybody else is and make sure you've got enough to breathe, and not sure whether it's going to work and trying to stay in control, there's an I who's caught in that fear. Does that make sense? All four of these are about self-grasping. But what can you tell me about the rosary? What have I said about a rosary?
The thread that links it is loving-kindness.
Yeah, but what are the deeds?
Motivation that carries you from one mind moment to the next, to the next. It's always changing.
One mental consciousness. They're like beads. And they change. If the circumstance changed, then a different self is there. You've seen that in yourself, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Driving down the street, minding your own business, a kid runs into the...
Oh.
Totally different self from just... isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't think of that as a different self, do we? Do we?
No.
No.
But when you look at it, you can see it actually is a different self, can't you?
Yes.
And when you look at your day, you can see that you've been a lot of different selves in one day, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're doing the same thing. There's 1 minute you're bored with it, 1 moment you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
1 minute you're thinking about something else while you're doing it. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
Yeah. So what is this I that we're grasping for? Does it really exist? It feels like it exists. But when you turn around and examine, even just since we sat down here and started reading that, there's been so many little eyes dancing through, hasn't there? It's incredible, isn't it? So they say in Buddhism, there is no fixed identity. Well, that's totally the opposite of how we feel. Would you agree?
Yeah, we think we're one thing. We're permanent.
Yeah. And we actually think we're permanent. We actually think we're going to die tomorrow, which never comes.
Yeah.
Which is also very interesting, isn't it?
But we think that, at least I think, that I'm an I doing different things. So 1 minute I'm driving along very calm, the next minute the kid jumps out, it's me doing something else.
But then... Who is the I that can do all those different things? Is that a solid, fixed identity? What happens to that I when you go to sleep?
It goes to sleep.
But where is isn't? How come there's not an I who can remember that? It feels like that.
Yeah.
How about somebody who has amnesia? And whole other mind states start coming up, but it's just not the same name.
Right. Or
the same numbers of mind states, but you don't know who you are. Can even be the same preferences or likes and dislikes, but
then what's the, you know, when you, when you're gapping, when you're like taking a cup of coffee and you put it in the fridge instead of the microwave, and you're standing there going, waiting for the microwave, which hasn't gone off, and you go to get the butter and discover the coffee in the fridge, and you go, oh. And not remembering, but seeing the evidence that that's what happened. What is that?
They're all different eyes, aren't they? The one who puts the coffee in the fridge is different than the one who's going to put it in the microwave. Aren't they?
Because it's connected with time, I don't know. Like, because 1 minute, there's somebody standing there putting coffee in the fridge with the intention of putting it in the microwave, but somehow the intention and the action didn't connect.
But the thought was to put it in the fridge, but there was no awareness in the putting, right? Because the eye was thinking about something else. Then another eye was thinking. So I think I'm going to put it in the fridge, and then as I'm walking in the microwave, as I'm walking that way, holding it, I think, oh, I should take something out of the fridge for dinner.
Right.
And then that eye puts it in the fridge.
Right.
But that isn't even remembered a minute later.
So
don't you ever start going to another room and then wonder what you went for?
Yeah, exactly.
Do we all do that sometime or other?
Yep.
Is there anybody who hasn't had that experience?
But then what is it that knows that that's happening?
The causes and conditions, the circumstances around. When you open the fridge and you see the coffee.
So if you're being, have awareness, that's still just one of the selves. Like if I'm...
No, awareness can be a thread.
But
it's any of the habits or threads.
It still feels like there's an I being...
It always feels like there's an I. Because as I have said before, and it's a hard one to get, but once you get it, once you see it in yourself, it's like, oh, for gosh sakes. Every I comes complete with the past and future. So when this I is up, it seems perfectly reasonable. This has always been me. I remember when I made that sign, and oh yeah, I was going to get my beard cut, but then I decided I'd wait for another 3 weeks. Right? And then another circumstance happens. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, and I remember when I first saw that house. And the other eye is totally forgotten, but this eye has its complete past and his future. So in every moment, it's like entering into a new, like a movie.
Right.
One picture changes into the next picture, and we connect them based on whatever the emotion is that's running.
So that one could be me sitting on a cushion being aware.
Yeah.
Like meditating. That's still...
And that one's like, is that what bird is that flew by? And that was like, all right, I've got to remember to go to that baby shower. I must get up. And that one is, I remember when I was a kid and I had a... And then that one is, oh yeah, it's so nice sitting here and watching the crystal formations of the breath.
So are those like thoughts though? Like this?
Yeah, exactly. That's how we're most aware of them, by thoughts. but they happen very, very quickly. The causes and conditions are continuously changing because there's this funny thing about life called impermanence. Have you noticed it? Oh, oh. Oh, my back. Oh. What?
So, what is this I that we're all such a slave to?
Habituation.
And to create safety.
Hunger, sleep, sex, and breath.
So would Olivia be an I? Would Olivia have a sense?
The propensities are there. And the fit with the parents are there. And then growing into it and having it manifest slowly. Have you seen more than one newborn baby?
Mm-hmm.
Are they all the same?
Mm-hmm.
Can they be quite different? How come? They're just newborn, aren't they? Just blank slates?
No.
Mm-hmm. Anything but, aren't they?
Oh yeah, there's something there, for sure.
Yeah. But the activation of it takes about 3 years for the whole brain to get working right and, you know, learning how to walk and all those things. And then about three, it's really there. You can really see the differences, can't you? This one loves music, this one doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. But we need this eye, our multiple eyes, to live in this world, but not be caught.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, the I is run by habituation from the past. Mm-hmm. The strongest of, and you remember that book, Willful Blindness, when I read you that quote about, you know, going down the river, you know. You do something one way, and then pretty soon, next time you do it the same way, and then after a while, it's easier just to go that way because you have before.
Mm-hmm.
You know how it works, and then so it's pretty soon it becomes, starts from just like a gutter, and then it becomes a creek, and then it becomes a river, and then the banks get higher and higher. And it's really smooth, and it's wonderful, and you can get from here to there really, really fast. It's just that you can't see anything else. Because the banks are so high.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a good analogy?
Mm-hmm.
And then when something happens to push you out of your stream, usually the reaction is anger, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Or fear.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Not gratitude.
No.
Not bowing and saying, thank you, girl, I was really asleep there. Not true?
Mm-hmm.
But it is a guru, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A big teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no inherent or fixed identity.
Mm-hmm.
There's identity.
Mm-hmm.
More identities than you can shake sticks at. And they string together depending on the aspiration, the main aspiration, don't they?
Mm.
Some people love music and they're musicians. Sometimes they're happy musicians, sometimes they're sad musicians. Sometimes they're indifferent, sometimes they're passionate. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Or artists, or writers, or street people, or any career. It's going to be one of the hardest things to wrap your mind around because we don't want to know that there isn't a fixed identity.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there is. But to actually turn around and question that. Which I is it that thinks something and starts acting toward it and then forgets it because you're thinking something else? And then doesn't notice the second thought a minute later. And so can't remember what happened with the first thought. There's a whole bunch of bodies.
Yeah,
there.
It's like some kind of ball that's sort of bouncing around. And,
a bunch of balls strung together.
Yeah.
I want a coffee.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I got to think about supper. Open the fridge. Heading toward the microwave. Okay, I'll just open. Just check. Oh, and so you put the coffee cup in, you start looking at things, then you close the door and you go, all right, my coffee must be ready. Oh, no, not yet. Coffee in the fridge. And not even seeing those different eyes. But they are different eyes, aren't they? The eye that wants a coffee wouldn't put the coffee in the fridge. But it doesn't feel like that, does it? Does it? Does it feel like it's a different Bob all the time?
No.
I find it's almost like the string gets broken quite often where, for example, the eye that wants a coffee puts it in the microwave and shuts the door and then gets distracted about something else and goes there, not even starting the microwave. And onto a completely different tack, and then 20 minutes later goes, gee, I'd like a cup of coffee. And then goes, I bet you I put one in the microwave and open it up, and oh, it's not even warm. I mustn't have started it. And back again.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens quite often to me, especially.
Yeah, but each of those eyes is a different, you know, when you're thinking something, then that's an eye who's going in that direction, and then you think something else, and that's an eye.
But I've noticed lately, gaps where it can be short, it can be the distance from me to Toby, but you notice that there, oh, that was a big gap. But just, you know it's a gap somehow.
Maybe they've always been there, but maybe you're noticing them.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe, okay.
Sometimes.
Or maybe there's more as we get older.
Okay.
Or maybe both. Did you ever, when you were a kid, forget to do your homework?
Oh, I'm sure I did, yeah.
Some things are easier to forget than other things.
I regularly
aren't they?
Yeah.
Yep.
And then another eye pops up with an excuse, don't they? Because
mm-hmm.
we have to present ourselves. Aunt my eye. Well, it was because you and I, and they and him, and there.
So we're learning all of these in the context of constantly changing environments then. Like, there's...
The aspiration is what creates the thread.
Well, like when we were talking earlier about doing things and then saying, realizing that, no, I don't want to ever do that again. That's
an aspiration, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if that is strongly held in a way that it's, I don't want to do it, then there is that sense of that is quite a strong river in one's being. Whereas if you do something stupid and miserable and nasty and then you apologize, then the person says, there, dear, it's okay. And then you're really good for a while, but you never actually address the issue of why you did it in the first place. And then you're really good and you give too much and all that, and then eventually the whole force builds up again, and then you do it again. So that creates that stream.
So is it that the aspiration influences all your eyes, or is it just that some drop out and other and new, more skillful ones come?
Aspirations can change, can't they?
Mm-hmm. But
Have you ever had an aspiration to be really nasty because nobody remembered your birthday? And you go home and they're having a surprise birthday party and you walk in?
Yeah.
Oh, oh, oh. And one second you open one side of the door, you got one aspiration. How could everybody forget me? And the other side of the door, oh my gosh, you guys are so wonderful. Like that. Can it?
Are those aspirations?
Well, it's the motive, right?
Oh, okay.
Motive of resentment and the motive of happiness.
Like what's motivating that, the current
eye? Yeah. The motive changes the eye, doesn't it? And so if you actually train yourself to have the motive of kindness, first to yourself. One of the things that happens if we really decide to be kind to ourselves is we become honest. Because we know it sucks how we feel when we're dishonest. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Don't we know that? And to actually be honest, not in your face, I'm going to tell you this, but like just to practice honesty. Is the kindest thing we can do for ourselves, isn't it? And then that starts opening us, and then we start wondering, what other people, who are you? Otherwise, we're always trying to project the right view of ourselves to everybody else and wondering whether they got the right view of us. We're not wondering who you are. It's true, isn't it? And honesty is so tied in my mind and in my experience with kindness. It's really kind to be honest with yourself, isn't it? You have to start liking yourself. You quit trying to be perfect as if that existed. It doesn't exist.
So all the selves.
All, yeah. All the selves, exactly. And you quit trying to make yourself into a cookie cutter, so. Which is a big relief, isn't it? And then when you do that, you don't have such projections on others, do you? And it's much easier to be kind. And when somebody is like caught in cookie cutter, you just really appreciate, oh, I know what they're doing, and you smile at them and wish them well. Because they're going to learn too. It's not up to you to fix them. You can just appreciate that they're reminding you of what you don't want to do. Can't you? Isn't that kindness? I think it is.
It's kindness in recognizing in the recognition then.
It, just in the recognition without trying to fix or anything. Actually, that person probably never lets anyone see them, but they probably really want to be seen. And you're seeing them. And appreciating what they're learning. And knowing that it's theirs to learn. And knowing that it can be done because you've done it.
Not having to point it out.
Why would you? That's just because you need the you need to be helpful. That's not loving yourself. Maybe the most helpful thing you could do is just notice when somebody's doing that and appreciate what they're learning. Is it possible?
Stretch. Just stretch.
Because it's clinging to a self to fix everybody, isn't it? That's what I do. Letting everybody be a mystery is different, isn't it? Everybody is a mystery, right? Think so.
Only happens once.
Pardon?
Only happens once, that person, with that mystery.
Yeah.
Can never happen again.
Unless they once. I'm reminded of that beautiful Zen koan. You can never step into the same river twice.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even step into the same river once. There's no such thing as the same river. If you're honest, there's only the moment. You're open. When you're open, you're practicing kindness. If there's nothing to protect, you're kind.
Mm-hmm.
And you see other people's sufferings and you have a sense of kindness for them. You don't have to go for the band-aids. You know they got power. Even just seeing it has power for them, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of empathy?
Mm-hmm.
Empathy is when you can feel what other people are feeling. So if you can see someone is caught in something and you just appreciate what they're working with, that empathy is passed on to them already. They have the empathy to feel that. Helps them see just by you seeing it.
By you seeing it, not doing anything about it.
Seeing it is doing something.
Seeing it is doing something. Or recognizing it, okay.
Recognizing it with kindness. And then if it progresses where there is some kind of actually spoken or unspoken request. But, you know, I don't know if you like the stories of my life. I could tell you another really good one. I was looking after my beloved teacher's house. He was gone for 3 years, and I was about 6 months after he bought it. And he asked me if I would stay in his house, so I was there for about 3 years. So there were big trees in the front yard, and I dug them all up, and mostly by hand. It was quite a job. And then borrowed my neighbor's truck and transported them further into the woods behind his house and replanted them. Actually, a couple of them are still there growing there. I'm amazed because I didn't know anything about repotting trees in those days. And he got the well fixed and, you know, planted a garden and went and gathered rocks to put around the garden and the pool. And, you know, I had a really great time fixing his house. It was really great. I just do whatever I wanted to. Got rid of the mice and, yeah, told him he had to get some cats, which he wasn't so fond of. But then I said, well, so you have really good fire insurance, do you? There was a silence on his end of the phone, and then he said, okay, it has to be Burmese, so I found a Burmese cat. And that took care of the mice. And then meanwhile, there was this friend of mine who lived just down the road from the Dharma Center, and she was married, and she had two kids, and she was really, really stretched for time and money, and she was like working two jobs and she was always short of time to get everything done. So I had finished doing a lot of the work. I didn't have a lot of work to do and I didn't have many things to, much teaching to do or anything at that point, and just in this little space of time. So I phoned her and I said, look, I'd really be happy. I know you're doing this and this and this on these days. I'd really be happy to take that on for you so you have a little more time for yourself. Oh, she said, that's so great. So then I go to the local AG, it's an AG in Kim Mountain. I'm shopping about 2 days later and there's my friend there and she says, oh, I just got to thank you so much. Just after you phoned, my neighbor across the street phoned and she needed somebody too. And as soon as I'd taken those 3 days, she got herself 4 days of even harder work. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
I thought she was a great teacher.
Yeah.
I said, thank you. And then shortly thereafter, I gave her back her job. She was really happy because then she was totally overstressed. That was hers to work on. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense because I just went through that.
Yeah.
Same thing in my head today, and some reading and study.
So, like, it's very interesting. Like, why is it that you want to help is an equally valid question. It's a good thing to do, and I appreciate how much you do for people. But why is it? You know, what is it that you need from that? It's just you don't beat yourself with that question. You just keep posing it. It just is an interesting question, and wait to see when your depth is ready to give you an answer. It can allow you to move it to another level. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, it's interesting in watching teachings from Kujol and then readings I do, or reading and then typing it out, and then I come and I listen to you, and I go home and do some more. Then it all goes tunk, 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 tunk.
Oh, good.
Yeah, your story now is just one that I created in my head about something that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Same story, just different.
Yeah, different characters, yeah.
Different eyes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then, if the right word is fruition, coming to the fruition of seeing it.
Yeah.
And being forced now to, not forced.
It's really coming up in your life for you to pay attention to.
Yeah, and the dictionary is becoming my friend, which was never my friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's the only book I can underline.
It's a good one. So, any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Or should I? Yes.
So, that's not that easy to do sometimes.
No, it isn't.
But I would like to think that the more you practice it, the stronger that it's like a muscle.
It is.
Gross.
It is.
Is that true?
That's exactly true.
That's great.
And any meditation helps you do that. Any calm abiding meditation helps you just hold the mind on one spot and watch the different cells come and go, doesn't it? My favorite one is the blue flower, as I've said before, because it's so bloody boring. Isn't it? It's just so boring. I mean, come on, give me a break. Right, sit there and look at it. But you do. You sit there and you look at it and you just kind of keep bringing your mind back. And what happens pretty soon, there's an I thought jumps up, doesn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And you just name it. Oh, that's just I thought worry or I thought desire or what, and you say later or sit here, and then you go back and just keep looking at the blue flower, and then another I thought, and then a whole series of memories will take you away totally, like a sailing through the Panama or something. Say, oh no, wait, I'm here, right? And you just keep bringing the mind back to something that has absolutely no interest for you. And just keep trying to see if you can open your eyes for 2 minutes and just scan it, and then slowly close your eyes and just see if you can see it with your eyes closed. So you're trying to see something that has nothing to do with an eye. But it's your mind, and you know you can see things in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So you are training your mind to be able to be aware of all the other eyes, but keep focusing on just holding the mind on a neutral point. It's a very powerful practice. A very powerful practice. I really recommend it. Watching the breath is the way it's usually done in the southern schools, or in Japan, with my beloved teacher, Ujiyama-san, you just stare at the wall and try to see what is it that is looking? What is it that is looking for the looker? And so, you know, and that kind of thing. And that was very powerful too. But it's really easy to get, I found with that, it's really easy to get caught in philosophical discussions, which then drill into fantasies and then memories, and then it's a half an hour later. And they're about to ring the bell to go and get up and walk, you know. And with the breath, it's really easy to sort of go into a sort of a catatonic in-breath, out-breath. And you sort of slide on the breath while the mind is still in the background thinking. That's my experience. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily sharpen the mind on one point. Whereas if you're actually trying to see the blue flower, you're aware of when you're not. And you actually begin to see all the different eyes as they arise, and you can actually start to identify them. And you're less likely to be caught by believing that they're a real eye. You can just see all of them come into being and pass away. And then you can ask, okay, what is it? What is the mental continuum? And then what is the mind on which these but what is the quality of the mind which allows all these different eyes to arise? Mm-hmm. Now that's a question. Mm-hmm. How come you can see things in your mind or think things in your mind?
How did we move to the point of being able to do that?
Would you say more about your question?
I don't know. I don't know whether I can. There's something there that's just niggling at the back of my brain that I can't quite.
So just go blah 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 and see what happens.
Yeah, it's kind of like the person that ate something, didn't like it very much, and said something to the person who'd given it to him. The other person said, well, you should spit it out fast because it's sulfuric acid or something. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thought that went through my mind. It was just, it was interesting because it wasn't like anything else I've ever done with my mind.
It was a beautiful thought, yeah. It was a beautiful thought.
Yeah. I'll have to sit on it.
And which we is what I was tempted to say, but I thought that was a little confusing. Mm-hmm. How can we do something with what is in our mind?
Yeah.
That wasn't quite her question, was it? Do you remember how she said it?
How did we get to how we could do this?
And how did it happen that I can do this or not? That we can do that with our mind.
Yeah.
Is that it? Is that closer?
Yeah.
Is that like how we evolved to be able to?
And the question, if I was going to pretend to be a Buddha, would go from the very no beginning. That you cannot name a beginning point.
Yeah.
But you can name an end point. Trying to name a beginning point is not possible.
Okay.
Because it's infinite. Yeah. But you can name an end point where you learn how to be aware of the mind in which the thoughts are playing.
Okay.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's always subject-object.
Yeah.
And if you want to know if there is anything that transcends suffering, it has to be something that transcends self-grasping, because all suffering is due to self-grasping. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Desire for something other than that which is present is suffering. Desire to be away from what is present is suffering. Desire for there to be no change, just stay in where I feel comfy, is suffering. Three types of suffering. I mention it in that writing.
Mm-hmm.
dream. And it covers all possibilities, doesn't it? So as long as there is a self who is grasping after one of those three sufferings, three states, three desires.
So if one is not grasping after any of
those. If there is no inherent identity, which there isn't, then is there, what is the mind on which an inherent identity seems to appear? What is the screen on which the movie plays? No screen, no movie. The screen can be the same regardless of what movie plays, can't it?
Yeah.
And it, every scene doesn't leave a smear or a mark on the movie on the screen, does it?
No.
Just comes and goes, doesn't it? So there is a quality to the mind that's like a movie screen, isn't there? Where our thoughts and our visions and our ideas appear very clearly, and then the next one, and then the next one. And a lot of our life isn't that different from films, is it? We're playing our movies, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And those movies are all about subject-object, aren't they? So what is there in our being that transcends subject-object? Well, the mind. But what is the mind? That's where Buddhism goes. Buddhism goes, if you understand the mind, then you can understand your own concepts of reality.
Someone has to look directly at the mind.
Yeah. And so we go back to Kubori-san. There is nothing wrong with the world. What is wrong is the way in which you look at it. Isn't that straightforward? It is your own imagination that misleads you. Without imagination, there is no world. Isn't that amazing? Your conviction that you are conscious of a world is the world. Your world is what you are convinced that you're conscious of. I know I put that coffee in the microwave.
Mm.
And then 1 minute later, oh, I know. The coffee is in the fridge. And then 1 minute later. The world you perceive is made of consciousness. And then he goes one further step, which I'm not even going to attempt tonight. What you call matter is consciousness itself. Do you have a copy of this one with you? Want another one, or is that good? You are the space in which it moves, the time in which it lasts, the love that gives it life. Cut off imagination and attachment, which is what I'm talking about, isn't it? And what remains? See it as it is, not through the screen of desire and fear. Everything moves according to its nature. Where is the need of a policeman? Every action creates a reaction, which balances and neutralizes the action. Everything happens, but there is a continuous canceling out, and in the end, it is as if nothing happened. The reality is indefinable and indescribable. The objective universe has structure, is orderly and beautiful. But structure, pattern, plan imply constraint and compulsion. The world is absolutely free. Everything in it is self-determined. Order comes spontaneously and immediately because of its timelessness. The point of now, it gives momentary being. a fleeting sense of reality. In full awareness, contact is established. In full awareness, contact is established. Complete, full, total immersion in the moment. No data coming from other, the mind totally focused in the moment. It means effortless, unselfconscious attention. There is nothing wrong with our world. It is our thinking ourselves separate from it that creates disorder. Where did the elements of your body come from? The world. Where are they going? To the world. Mm-hmm. It's just a flow, just a river. No distinction between body and universe. Each is the cause of the other. Each is the other in truth. The notion, I see, I feel, I think, I do, must disappear from the field of consciousness. What remains when the false is no more is real. Without love and will, inspired by love, nothing can be done. Merely talking about reality without doing anything about it is self-defeating. There must be love in the relation between the person who says, I am, and the observer of that I am. The self who says I am, and the observer. The awareness of that saying. The observer considers himself apart from the observed. It is only when the observer accepts the person as a projection or manifestation of himself, and so to say, takes a small s self into the large s self, that the duality of I and this goes in the identity of outer and inner, and the supreme reality manifests. This union of the seer and the seen happens when the seer becomes conscious of himself as the seer. He is not merely interested in the seen, which he is anyway, but also interested in being interested. Giving attention to attention, aware of being aware. Affectionate awareness is the crucial factor that brings capital R reality into focus. Awareness comes from the supreme and pervades the inner self. The so-called outer self is only the part of what, that part of oneself, of one's being, of which one is not aware. The body defines the outer self, consciousness, the inner. You see me smoking. Find out for yourself. How did you come to see me smoking? And you will easily realize that it is your I am the body state of mind that is responsible for this I see you smoking idea. Go beyond your concepts and ideas. In the silence of desire and thought, the truth is found. Earnestness is the golden. Isn't that a beautiful piece of writing? Mm-hmm. It's just at the edge of being able to taste, isn't it? But you can hear some distant bell ringing, can't you? Mm-hmm. There is a reality that transcends subject-object duality. It is called liberation. When that is experienced, then the consciousness comes back. That's called perfection. Then the consciousness comes back into subject-object reality, but with a knowing of truth, a knowing of totality. Then subject-object duality becomes the work of compassion, not self-grasping. Mm. Mm. Every school of Buddhism has its own way of trying to show people how to take that path to go beyond self, subject-object duality. They each have a value. I have had the good fortune of practicing three of those schools in some depth, not nearly as deep as I should have, given the good circumstances that I had, because I tend to be lazy. But with very good teachers and very wonderful support. And I don't see any difference in what they're all aiming at. I think for different people, different paths work better. But each of them has a possibility of getting stuck.
Each has what?
A possibility of getting stuck. In the Tibetan, there can be a possibility of getting stuck on trying to do the ritual right.
Oh, okay.
In the Theravadin, there can be a getting stuck on being able to really focus on the breathing and go into la-la land. In the Mahayana, there can be a focus on really trying to remember to do everything for the benefit of others. Each of them has. In Zen, it can just get into a way of isolating oneself from the rest of the world. Does this make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They also have equally strong points. We need each other in order to be able to stay aware of when we're sinking into the not-so-strong points, when we're actually interested in the strong points, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I personally really would like to know if there is a way to transcend dissatisfaction. How about you? Okay, so it seems like as long as there is self-clinging, there is dissatisfaction, because there's becoming. Do you think that's true?
Mm-hmm.
As long as there's a self, there's something you're going to become.
Mm-hmm.
Next moment, next moment. So it has to be something that steps outside of time, outside of subject-object. Outside of thought.
Oh, damn.
I'm so brilliant. But it is thought that will take us there.
Hmm.
Or as the Tibetans say, using illusion to conquer illusion. So that's what I wanted to talk about tonight. Is that okay? I sort of thought I'd jump in the deep end.
Yeah.
Yes.
The life jacket. I want to say this, but I hope it isn't a confusing analogy, but I feel like sense of self, I have to go to the future or the past, and if I'm watching the screen, the only time the clarity of the screen is there is in the present moment, and it's like I'm the bulb of the projector and the projector, and the screen is there in the present moment, and it's perfectly clear until I go to the past.
For the future?
Future.
Yeah.
So.
Or any kind of, even we can even separate and be watching something in the present, which is just a millisecond of either past or future, isn't it?
Yeah.
I am watching. It's already just a millisecond off.
Yeah.
But
you're exactly right.
It
totally feels right that all of a sudden you can drop it. Then it's like you have to drop.
But you have to train yourself to do that, don't you? Because look at how our thoughts go. Endless.
But that's actually not boring.
When you actually bring the mind just to the present moment, it becomes so blissful. Yes.
So we have the observer, or the capital S self, who's seeing these other selves appearing, right? But they're, I'm assuming those are the selves you were talking about before, you know, the putting the cup in the microwave or in watching this. And when the observer understands that there's a, it's just a part of it, it there's like this unification, right?
Yeah.
But there's still a separateness from the rest.
No,
that's where I
know. When you are watching, when you are watching the steam from a kettle dissolve, you can be watching all the steam dissolve, but you suddenly become aware that that's not separate from the air you're breathing in, and the air you're breathing in isn't separate from the air you're breathing out, and that there is no separation of anything at all. You ever had that experience? And magnify it even more. And then there is no separation of anything, any place, anywhere. It's not something one can describe. They call it boundless states. And they say in all of the schools that it's really useful to experience a boundless state and then ask the right question. If you experience a boundless state but then don't ask the right question, you just get stuck in la-la land. So, you know, in Zen you ask, you know, all these different questions. All the questions which don't have an answer to stop the mind. But you keep pushing for an answer. So that you start, the thoughts won't work anymore. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the mind goes into that seer scene, and then there'll be a turn. It feels like a turn. In fact, they call it that. They call it turning about in the seat of consciousness.
It feels like the observer is not the mind.
Then there's also a quality of awareness that is behind the observer. That's the one that is you.
That is really.
Yeah, that's what. The observer is more like the self, isn't it?
It's a self.
Yeah. Yeah. Who sometimes goes to sleep. Some other self takes over. Sleepwalks. Okay, is that adequate sufficiency?
Mm. That's great.
Good. My pleasure.
Mm. Our pleasure.
Yes.
Mm. You notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts. Mm-hmm. Tingle, tingle. Up your spine, down your spine, out your shoulders, out your hips, down your legs, down your arms, up your head. Spreads out through this room, through the house, got the cab, plants. All Bob's artwork went what? Through the neighborhood. Out into the world, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, four quarters. Just spreads out wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind. It's just temporarily assuaged. You think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Thank you. you for your great compassion.
Thank you. Do you have all the plates?
I do.
Okay. Is there Guja tomorrow?
Guja tomorrow. Chenrezig.
Hey.
I understand it's quite a nice place.
And you're not back teaching again until
June.
June, is it?